Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion, everybody. This is Frank Cogliano here in Edinburgh. I'm here with my colleague David Silkenat.
How are you, David? It's good to be on this side of the chair at one point, a desk.
Yes, I'm leading off today. I'm introducing, for reasons which I think will become apparent in the next couple of minutes. It is presently the 4th of May, or May the 4th, Star Wars Day. Happy Star Wars Day to you. I'm saying that because as we speak, Congress has begun voting on the repeal of Obamacare and so on. We won't be addressing that today because we don't know the outcome of that vote. So we'll probably have to leave that to another time, although I think that's a story that will run and run. The reason I am making the introduction today is because, as many of you will know, President Trump, and I will say we had a Trump-free episode last week, but we're not having one this week. President Trump had some interesting things to say in an interview, which I think was broadcast on Monday with Selena Zito from the Washington Times, about Andrew Jackson and the American Civil War. And because David is an expert on the Civil War, I really wanted to kind of give him free rein to express himself on this question. But before that, we've got just a brief clip of President Trump's remarks, which we're going to play, and then I will allow David to respond to those. So, here's the clip.
They said, my campaign is most like my campaign and win was most like Andrew Jackson,
right,
with his campaign. And I said, when was Andrew Jackson? It was 1828. That's a long time ago. That's Andrew Jackson. And he had a very, very mean and nasty campaign because they said this was the meanest and the nastiest. And unfortunately, it continues.
His wife died.
His wife died.
Yeah.
They destroyed his wife and she died. And, you know, he was a swashbuckler. But when his wife died, you know, he visited her grave every day. I visited her grave, actually, because I was in Tennessee.
Oh, that's right. You were in Tennessee.
And it was amazing. The people of Tennessee are amazing people. Well, they love Andrew Jackson. They love Andrew Jackson in Tennessee.
Yeah, he's a fascinating
guy. I mean, had Andrew Jackson been a little bit later, you wouldn't have had the Civil War. He was a very tough person, but he had a big heart, and he was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. He said, there's no reason for this. People don't realize, you know, the Civil War.
Yeah.
You think about it, why? People don't ask that question. But why was there the Civil War? Why could that one not have been worked out?
Phew. Okay. David, would you like to respond?
Oh, jeez. There's so much to unpack here. I think I'm going to start actually with the last thing that he said, where the president says, people don't ask that question, but why was there the Civil War? This is has to be the most asked question ever in the history of American history. I don't think there's more. What, Frank?
Well, I was just going to say, we're sitting in David's office, and I'm looking at a shelf full of books
yeah,
on the Civil War. So I mean,
there are tens of thousands of books written on this. This is the question that you know we ask in middle school, we ask in high school, we ask here at university. You know, it's a question on the citizenship test. One of the 100 questions they ask when you ask become a U.S. citizen is, you know, what caused, and there's even multiple right answers they give that they allow you to answer on that. I mean, there was a Simpsons episode where Apu is applying for citizenship, and the last question he gets asked is, why was the Civil War? And he goes off, he starts this very lengthy, convoluted answer, and the examiner says, just say slavery, and he says, slavery it is, sir, and then he says, congratulations, you're a citizen. This is like the most cliched question, and the most, you know, so for him to rhetorically ask this question about why was there a Civil War is just mind-boggling. I mean, given that two of his wives are immigrants and have taken this test and presumably passed it somehow, you know, it hurts the brain, right? Let's go, I'm going to sort of try to see if I can sort of take this passage apart in as much as I can try to take apart anything Trump. Yes.
Listeners, I want to warn you. You can't see David, but I can. I'm actually concerned for his health. He's becoming very agitated about this.
Before I get started, Trump clearly has a weird relationship with history. There was a story that came out early in the campaign, back when nobody took Trump as a serious candidate, about one of this golf course that he owns in Virginia. I'm sure it's a very nice golf course, whatever. But he bought this golf course, and he decided to deck it out when he bought the golf course. And one of the things he added to the golf course was a plaque. And the plaque's is on the Potomac River. And it says, the plaque says, "The River of Blood. Many great American soldiers, both in the North and the South, died at this spot. The casualties were so great, the water would turn red and thus become known as the River of Blood." Right? Which is great, except for the fact that there was no battle anywhere remotely near there, that this appears to be made up. And Trump was asked, you know, where did this come from? He said, well, I talked to historians. And then they asked, well, which historians? Well, I didn't talk to historians. My people talked to historians. Well, which historians and which people? And they didn't answer the question. When people challenged him on this and said, well, historians said there wasn't a battle there. And then his response was, how do the historians know they weren't there? Which clearly means he doesn't really understand what we do for a living, or how documents work and how evidence works, but I think we already know that, right? So back to this quotation. He starts off with he has this love affair with Jackson, but he starts off with talking about Rachel Jackson, Andrew Jackson's wife. And I'm not sure what this says about his own marriage. I don't want to psychoanalyze that too much. But the story about Rachel Jackson, about the part where she died, Rachel Jackson had been married previously, before she marries Andrew Jackson, gets a divorce. And getting a divorce in the early 19th century in the American South was an extraordinarily rare phenomenon. This isn't, you know, the 1990s New York or something where everybody was getting divorced. This was a time when divorce was very rare and very stigmatized. And her divorce, it appears, was not finalized the time that she married Andrew Jackson. And the press got wind of this and labeled her a bigamist for having been married, legally at least, to two people simultaneously. And this was an issue during the campaign when he was running for president. And after he's elected, before he takes office, she dies. And she had been sick for a long time, but one of the things that he does after after her death is he blames the media, blames the sort of critique of her for hastening her death. Trump seems to like this story. This seems to be a story that is buried in his brain. I'm imagining he went to the Hermitage. You went to Jackson's house, what was it, like a couple of weeks ago, Frank? Does that sound right? A month ago?
About a month or so.
About a month ago.
He certainly visited as president.
So he went there and he says, you know, and presumably he heard that story then, and that's why he's repeating it. He says in the little passage here that Jackson went and visited her grave every day, which is not really true, because she dies in December of 1828. He then moves to Washington to be president for 8 years, and she's buried in Tennessee. So presumably he didn't visit her grave every day for the 8 years that he was not there. After his presidency, he's obviously in Tennessee near her grave, but her grave is on the grounds of his plantation. So visiting her grave every day, you know, it's not like one of the most recent Rocky movie where Rocky goes and visits, you know, Adrian's grave every day and has to carry a chair or whatever it is. No, it's not that. Like, he had to, like, walk outside of his house in 100 yards to get to her grave. So it wasn't as much of a... Anyway, that story seems to be important to him. All right, so then we get into the really troubling bits in this passage. Where he talks about, had Jackson been around during the Civil War, that the Civil War wouldn't have happened. Now, Jackson dies in 1845, so he wasn't around. And Trump later clarifies in a tweet, I think he says, like, you know, I knew he was dead then. It's, as in lots of his passages, it's hard to figure exactly what he's talking about here. But then he says he was a very tough person, but he had a big heart. I have no idea what the hell that means. I don't know what your thoughts on that, Frank, because he's... I've never seen a huge number of examples of Jackson having a big heart anywhere except maybe for his wife.
Well, and he adopts a Native American boy, which much is made of that by Jackson's defenders to try and say that he's not an Indian hater, for example. So there is that. I mean, clearly, we'll get to this. I want to give you time to work through your Civil War issues. But in terms of his attitude towards Jackson, he sees himself in Jackson, I think. So he's clearly... describing himself
there. Oh, that's, I think that's really, okay. Then we get to the real problematic part. He was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. Now, when Jackson dies, we're not even clear that we're anywhere close to the Civil War happening. So he dies 15 or 16 years before secession and before the war starts. At the moment,
and before the Mexican War, crucially,
yes. I mean, so the Mexican War hasn't happened. You know, when he dies in 1845, he would probably look at the country and say, "Yeah, this is pretty good." James K. Polk had just been elected. Polk, you know, had modeled himself on Jackson. Polk is called Young Hickory after, nicknaming after Jackson. So the Mexican War hadn't happened. You know, the Wilmot Proviso consequentially hadn't happened. All the sort of fight and compromise of 1850, none of that stuff had happened yet. So, what is he talking about here? The nearest I can guess, and this is sort of exam season, I'm going to sort of do the kind of thing I do where I try to, like, assume the best of the student and try to figure out what, like, the student was talking about on their exam essays, which sometimes it requires some tea leaf reading. I'm assuming he's talking about the nullification crisis here. Do you think that...
Yes, I mean, that must be... I want to... This will be recorded for posterity, so I want to choose my words carefully. I do think, I mean, he clearly, Trump that is, not Andrew Jackson, has a problem expressing himself clearly.
Yes.
And indeed, the presidency seems to be exacerbating that and making it worse. To give him his due, not to try and defend these comments, but to try and explain them, I do think the beginning of that passage, David, where he says, I mean, had Andrew Jackson been a little later... you wouldn't have had the Civil War. And then he goes on, he switches tenses.
Yes.
And then
he has issues with tenses.
He does, in the same way that he talks about Frederick Douglass,
yes,
as though he was still alive back in February during Black History Month. So what I mean is, or what I'm saying in his defense is, there's a kind of tense switch here. But I do think that had he been alive, there may be some understanding in his view that Jackson wasn't alive during the Civil War. I agree with you when he talked about there wouldn't have been a Civil War. That resonates with all kinds of the kind of alt-right interpretation of the Civil War as not really having been about slavery and so on and so forth. But I do think he's referring to the nullification crisis.
Which we should probably summarize.
Tell our listeners the
Cliff Note version of the nullification crisis. In 1828 and 1832, Congress passes tariffs, taxes on imports. These were deeply unpopular in the South because the South wasn't... The tariffs were designed for protecting American manufacturing, mostly in the North. The tariff made goods more expensive in the South. South didn't like it. And South Carolina says, look, we don't like this tariff. We are nullifying the tariff in South Carolina. We are not going to collect these taxes. We consider ourselves exempt as a sovereign state. Jackson responds by saying, going to Congress and saying, if South Carolina refuses to uphold the law, I want the authority to go and invade South Carolina, essentially, to use military force to enforce the constitutional power of the federal government. And eventually what happens is Congress ends up producing the tariff and South Carolina backs down. So it's often seen as being a precursor for the Civil War, in part because it has South Carolina doing rebellious South Carolina things. it's about questions about state power versus federal power, which obviously has some sort of correlation with the secession movement, 30 years later. So it's often sort of seen as a sort of hallmark, a precursor for the Civil War, and Jackson comes out as a defender of the Constitution, defender of federal power, even if, on the issue itself, he was actually fairly sympathetic with South Carolina, in as much as he didn't like the tariff either. So that's the grossly oversimplified version of that. Here's my concern with there's sort of lots of concerns I have, but the big concern I have with this is twofold. One is he thinks Jackson's a really good negotiator, in part because I think this is sort of him modeling, thinking of Jackson and himself as being the same person.
David, he thinks he's a really good negotiator.
Okay, to be sure. His self-image he is projecting onto Andrew Jackson, and both of them are wrong. But Jackson was not a good negotiator. Like, Jackson's skill was, since the Star Wars day, negotiating with a lightsaber to quote Attack of the Clones, right? Like, it's... happy Star Wars Day, everybody. he's not Jimmy Carter, negotiating peace in the Middle East, getting people to see, their mutual, self-interest kinds of things. Jackson was effective when he used force. He's somebody who got into more than two dozen duels. This is not a guy who was able to use words and the power of rhetoric to resolve things.
Nor is he somebody who can empathize with others and walk in their own shoes.
No, I mean, his go-to move, Jackson's go-to move, was to use force, whether it's personal force, in challenging somebody to a duel, or going to war, which he did, repeatedly. He obviously sort of built his reputation on his performance in the War of 1812 and then the Creek War and what have you. Jackson's not a good negotiator, and Jackson couldn't have had he lived an extra 15, 16 years. Couldn't have negotiated much of anything because he wasn't a good negotiator. The bigger problem I have with this is that I think he sees the Civil War, Trump sees the Civil War as something that could have been resolved through a negotiation. And the problem with that is there had been negotiations, there had been compromises in the lead up to the Civil War. And we can think of the history of the previous 75 years as a series of negotiations on the question of slavery, starting with the Constitution, with the Missouri Compromise, with the Compromise of 1850, with the Kansas-Nebraska Act. There's a series of compromises, and all of those compromises ultimately come on the backs of enslaved people. That any compromise the South would agree to be one that continued slavery. And, any compromise that Jackson would have come to, but it would have been one that would have enshrined and protected slavery. So in as much as we should, celebrate the Civil War because it led to the emancipation of 4 million people, which is the most important outcome of the Civil War, Jackson wouldn't have done that. And Trump seems totally oblivious to that consequence of the war. He sees the war, at least as much as I can infer from this passage, as a bloody conflict that could have been avoided had the proper set of negotiators been around to fix it. And in some ways there, he's actually harking back to a much earlier generation of historians. There was a group of historians known as revisionists. Going back to this question of, has anyone actually asked this question before? Yes, many, many times. The revisionists thought that, the Civil War could have been avoided because it was a product of a bumbling generation of politicians, in the 1850s. And in many ways, the revisionists were actually sort of looking back at World War One and figuring, well, World War One happened as a consequence of political ineptitude.
When were the revisionists writing?
So the revisionists are writing often in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. So then the aftermath of World War One, they're looking at World War One, say, well, this horrible war could have been avoided, and they sort of map that back as the trick for historiography for all the grad students out there is figure out what's going on politically when the historians are writing, and then that's pretty much 9/10 of the answer. And so maybe Trump is, who knows what's going on in his, the history lesson in his head, but that he's in some ways reflecting that. But one of the things that the revisionist historiography sort of ignored was the entire question of slavery and the way that slavery was really fundamental to cause the war, and the outcome of the war was fundamentally tied up with black freedom. So, you know, this whole passage just made me profoundly angry, although, you know, anytime Trump says much of anything, that's usually my end result.
Well, okay, David, I want us to, in a minute, to move back to his, to reflect a little bit on his Jackson obsession, but before that, I wonder if you might consider or reflect upon the degree to which, I mean, a lot of the commentary this week suggested that this particular interpretation of the Civil War, or that Trump seems to hold, may originate with Steve Bannon and the alt-right. Could you explain and reflect on that? I mean, to some extent, you've done that with the revisionists. What's the line we can draw from the revisionists in the 20s and 30s to Breitbart and Steve Bannon today? Or can we draw such a line?
I think we're over-intellectualizing it. I think Trump's just profoundly ignorant more than anything else. You know, I'm not sure Steve Bannon's feeding him historiography, although that'd be amusing if we can see Steve Bannon doing that. You know, I think one of the ways in which we explain the importance of the Civil War and we explain the sort of important themes of the 19th century more broadly is this question about black slavery and black freedom and black citizenship and the ways in which those are the contested questions and categories. In the kind of American history that I think Trump has in his head, and as much as he has much history in his head, it's one in which those questions aren't even relevant. And that, you know, he has a very sort of, you know, if we're going to sort of find a Steve Bannon thread in here, it's that, you know, he has a very sort of white nationalist conception of American history. And, you know, if, assuming that you know, so Trump was alive during the Civil War centennial. And historians who have looked back at the Civil War centennial, what kind of story was told about the Civil War during the centennial, this sort of public event, I think actually has some echoes in this passage, in as much as he see, and in this stupid plaque on his golf course, which is factually inaccurate, but the sort of underlying text of it is, here's a, you know, a war between Americans in the North and Americans in the South, and we can celebrate both equally, and Americans are coded as white in the centennial message, and the story about slavery and the story about emancipation was very much buried, and it was buried on purpose during the centennial. You know, the Civil War centennial was organized nationally. Congress appointed a committee, and the people who headed the committee said, like, this is the story we want to tell, is about American national unity. How you tell a story about national unity in the context of telling the story of a civil war is beyond me. But that's the story they were sort of tasked themselves with telling. And, you know, thinking about, and they very clearly, explicitly decided not to talk about emancipation, in part because, you know, they thought that would be too divisive because of the civil rights movement, etc. The subtext there is obvious. Trump would have been, I guess Trump was born in late 1940s?
Yeah, so he would have been teens.
He would have been sort of right in that formative, in terms of, you know, the when he would have been interested in history, when he would have been in military school, would have been during the Civil War centennial. And I think he may, and I don't think he's been reading that many history books since then, that may be where part of this is coming from.
Interesting. We discussed Andrew Jackson a little bit several weeks ago when we talked about Mark Cheatham and Jackson and his essay about Jackson and Trump. So we probably don't need to belabor this too much, but one of the things that came up here, came up in this passage, is his what might be called Jackson fixation or Jackson obsession. And he's got a portrait of Jackson in the Oval Office, which is quite telling.
I think that the portrait was why this actually came up in the interview. I think they were walking around the Oval Office and he point out the portrait, and so I think that's.
Yeah. I mean, it's Jackson's a very curious choice, and I think, you know, you emphasize the quote about Jackson having a big heart, being a tough person with a big heart. He describes him, that is, Trump describes Jackson as a swashbuckler. I mean, he appears to have a great deal of admiration for Andrew Jackson. For us, this, and certainly for myself, but I think I speak for you as well, this is a curious choice.
Yes.
The president says swashbuckler, I say kind of slave driver and Indian killer.
Yeah.
You know, Jackson is not an... He's not a very admirable person in many respects, and that's not me imposing my own modern values on him. Contemporaries thought that.
Yeah, I mean, somebody who's in like a 24 duels clearly is not good at making friends.
Right.
He's somebody who had very, you know, like his political enemies created a party to oppose him. Like, this is the, you know, one of the most divisive figure. I mean, maybe that's part of what Trump sees in Jackson, is that he sees himself. Trump is a very divisive figure. I think people love Trump, and then there's the rest of us. And Jackson, I think, was very much the same way.
And Jackson did identify himself as the champion of the common man.
Yeah.
With arguably more credibility making that claim than Trump has.
No, to be sure.
But Jackson is a deeply problematic figure in all kinds of ways. But I think his vision of Jackson, that is Trump's, resonates with his vision of America, which is the one you so eloquently outlined a moment ago. The norm for Trump, the normative American, is a white male.
Yeah.
And Jackson is the champion of white males.
Yeah.
The Jackson who is the architect of Indian removal, or a champion of the slave trade, the internal slave trade, and the practice of slavery, doesn't really figure, because these are tangential issues as far as Trump's concerned. Also, in the past week, Trump has used Pocahontas as an insult directed at Elizabeth Warren again. And that, of course, is racist.
Yeah.
So this suggests that the Trumpian view of American history, in contrast to our view of American history, is fairly narrow, fairly old-fashioned, and is premised on a white supremacist nationalist narrative.
So if there's any redeeming bit in this, it did actually lead me to question, had Jackson lived an extra 15 years, which side would he have fought on in the Civil War? Which I think actually you could have a...
He would have been 90.
Well, so I mean, there's two sort of analogs. Well, I mean, so Jackson clearly is a Southerner and a slaveholder, and you know, identifies as both, but he also identifies himself as a defender of the Constitution, nullification crisis, and what have you.
And a nationalist.
And yes, very much so. So is he more like the Winfield Scott, you know, who also, like him, fought in the war?
Not all of our listeners may know Winfield Scott was,
David. Winfield Scott fire. So Winfield Scott from Virginia was probably the biggest, one of the biggest military heroes of the first half of the 19th century. Fought in the War of 1812, was one of the important generals in the Mexican War, one of the sort of big triumvirate of along with Fremont and Zachary Taylor, who fought in the Mexican War. He had the nickname Old Fuss and Feathers because he supposedly liked to wear very ornate uniforms. He was very tall. He looked really great in a horse. By the time you get to 1860, he is the highest ranking general in the Union Army, although at that point he's 300 pounds or so, can't basically get up. He's fairly ill. But he's the founder of the Anaconda Plan, beginning of the Civil War. The reason why, so he's sort of a Southerner who decides to stay with the Union in 1860-1861 versus somebody like Robert E. Lee, also from Virginia, you know, also a slaveholder, but somebody who in 1861 decides to side with the Confederacy. Jackson, I think, has that, you know, is in that sort of same sort of liminal space where he has, had he been alive, and, you know, he would have been in some ways sort of like, Winfield Scott, far too old to actually do much of anything, but, you know, the question, you know, the ideological power he would have had, well, probably would have been significant, even if he would have been really, really old at that point.
At risk of indulging President Trump, I think he would have stayed with the Union. The crucial distinction being that it wasn't just that he had a military background. Mm. He'd served two terms as president, so yes. He had kind of a stake in the United States. And if one thinks about the nullification crisis, you know, his position was pretty clear then. Yeah.
Although Tyler was in the Confederate Congress after being president.
That's a good point.
Granted, he was only briefly president. But Jackson was claimed by the Confederacy.
Sure. Well, they claimed...
They claimed Washington.
Washington and Jefferson and everybody else,
right? But, you know, one could actually have a reasoned argument either way, I think, with what side Jackson would have ended up on. I'm actually betting he would have sided with the Confederacy. I don't think he would have been willing to side with Lincoln on
that's a bona fide difference of opinion here on the Whiskey Rebellion, ladies and gentlemen.
The counterfactual historical, not entirely relevant to much of anything. What side would, you know, had aliens a lot arrived at that point, then we can, you know.
Okay, listeners, we want you on Twitter to tweet at us which side you think Andrew Jackson would have fought on in the Civil War.
Because that matters. Okay, good. Zombie Jackson. Yeah, that's good. Well, you know, Abraham Lincoln vampire.
So David, one of the things in all the commentary this week, one of the things that was stated, there was a great, this set of comments engendered a pretty significant response on social media and elsewhere from historians.
Sure.
Everyone from the would-be historian Bill O'Reilly, who endorsed the
America's
results,
best-selling historian,
some of our friends and colleagues, and indeed ourselves. And there was some, I think there was a story in it might have been the New York Times in the past 2 days about this is kind of a political awakening for historians. Do you agree with that?
I think historians have been politically awake for at least as long as I've been sort of cognizant of what the profession has been doing. I mean, there is, you know, this note that historians should be sort of like journalists and we should be politically non-biased, but most historians, at least within the academic part of the profession, I think are fairly politically engaged and you know, allow their, maybe not necessarily in the classroom, what we present in the classroom, we try to, I think, sometimes to be less partisan, but I think, you know, in their personal lives are often quite partisan.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Do you think that Trump has inadvertently done us all a favor? I mean, there's been more discussion now, and presumably this will continue, about Andrew Jackson, for goodness sake, and the origins of the Civil War.
Well, I mean, I think...
As a Civil War historian...
One thing I tweeted earlier this week, and most entirely in jest, is maybe what Trump is doing here is trying to educate America on its past by saying stupid things and then giving us a plot. I mean, we're talking, you know, people are talking on the news about Andrew Jackson. There's been more public debate about Andrew Jackson than there has been since 1850. You know, and the regularity with which Trump is making entirely ignorant claims about the past, whether it's Andrew Jackson, whether it's Frederick Douglass, God help us what he's going to say on the 4th of July. You know, it gives us a sort of a vehicle and an avenue for talking about the past that we probably wouldn't have had he not said a stupid thing about it.
It's certainly great for those who write about Jackson, like Mark Cheatham and John Meacham and Dan Feller. I've got to say, I'm feeling a little neglected that he hasn't said anything outrageous about Jefferson yet. But
he already has said a few things about.
Right, so David, let's. I hope you feel better. This has been cathartic for you.
Well, a little slight, this much, right?
Okay. Yeah, I can. What's your last drop, David?
All right, and this is in some ways a little bit linked to all this. I think many people listening, I think we talked briefly previously on previous episodes about the story about Georgetown, Georgetown coming to grips with its history of slavery. And I want to endorse a two-part series that was on NPR's Planet Money that has looked at Georgetown's relationship to slavery. And they, you know, they do this sort of general story about the 272 slaves that were sold in 1838 to help bolster the finances of the university, slaves that were sold into Louisiana. But the Planet Money team goes down into Louisiana and talks to some of the descendants of those slaves. But then they get into a really interesting discussion about what both those descendants and what academics have thought about what Georgetown and what America more generally owes the descendants of slaves for slavery. So the question about reparations, both in the specific case, but in a more general case. And so they get into the economics and some of the economic sort of calculations about how you'd go about doing it. And they don't really come to any firm conclusions, but I think they have a very interesting discussion about sort of the personal cost and how one could quantify that if one wanted to. So I want to endorse the Planet Money segment on the Georgetown 272. What you got, Frank?
Right. As you know, I am a Boston Red Sox fan. There was an unfortunate incident at Fenway Park earlier this week in Boston when the Red Sox were playing the Baltimore Orioles. And Adam Jones from the Orioles was subjected to abuse from, well, it's unclear how many fans, but he was subjected to racial abuse by fans, and a bag of peanuts was thrown at him. And this was widely reported earlier in the week. The Red Sox responded relatively well in the sense that many of the players on the team expressed their regrets about this. The owner of the team went and personally apologized to Jones. The next night, Jones received a standing ovation when he came up to bat in the first inning. And so in that sense, it was dealt with, an unfortunate incident was dealt with relatively quickly and relatively well. The reason this is significant, I think, is there are a couple of reasons for it. The first is that there's a very long history of the Red Sox have a very bad history where race is concerned.
I think they were the last major league team to have an African American player.
They were. They didn't integrate. So Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball in 1947. The Red Sox did not sign and start Pumpsy Green, who was their first African American player, until 1959.
Jeez.
So they were the last player the last team to integrate. And historically, black players have had difficulty in Boston, until the recent past, I should say. Things were particularly acute in the 1970s during the busing crisis and the crisis over the desegregation of schools in Boston during the 1970s, which was also a time when the Red Sox had a number of very good teams, but they had black stars and white stars, and there was some there was a great disparity in the way they were treated by the public. And so there's a kind of rather unfortunate history there. The longtime owner of the Red Sox, Tom Yawkey, was he opposed integrating the team. He, early in his life, was a segregationist. I mean, there were some real problems with Tom Yawkey. So the history of the team was not good. In recent years, it improved dramatically, in part because the team, like the city, had become so much more diverse.
Yeah.
And one hoped that the corner had been turned. At least I hope that. Doesn't seem to be the case. Yeah, well, it was, I don't want to overstate this. It may well be the case, and the team currently is as diverse as it's ever been, which is interesting. So I don't know whether these comments that Adam Jones was subjected to are a product of that history, and if you read message boards and things like that online, there's a lot of commentary to that effect, with lots of fans of other teams saying, that's Boston, that's the way Boston is, those are the Boston fans, and there's a history there. Or, and this might be even more worrisome, if it's not a product of this moment. Because what we've seen in the past couple of years is people, especially white Americans and white males of a certain age, and that's the baseball demographic, feeling that they can express themselves and they're somehow being authentic. And that, you know, you can say what you want, you know, political. And Trump really made a lot of play about this in his assault on political correctness.
It sounds like a Trump rally.
It does sound, and this kind of language, this, you know, racist language was used at a lot of Trump. And so I don't know whether it's a product of that or the history. It's undoubtedly both. It's a terrible, terrible moment, but I will offer a little bit of hope in the sense that in soccer, football here in the UK, this used to be a real problem, mm-hmm. the use of very, I mean, racist language. I have season tickets to one of the local teams here in Edinburgh, and I will tell you the language is unlike anything you hear in the United States at a sporting event. It involves lots of gerunds and genitalia. But the one thing one hears rarely is racist language. In part, they make an announcement before every match mm-hmm. saying this language, sectarian and racist language will not be tolerated. You do hear some sectarian language in Scotland, more than racist language. And there is, it's legislated against. Yeah. So there's the Offensive Behaviour at Football and Communications Act.
Yeah.
And indeed, a fan at Glasgow Rangers was arrested recently for using racist language yeah. directed at a player for Celtic, which is Rangers' great rival. And so this is against the law here. Mm. And having attended football matches in England and Scotland now for 25 years, I can tell you it's not unknown, but it's pretty rare to hear yeah. racist language. By contrast with places like Spain and Italy, where it's still quite good common. Job, yeah. Bananas are thrown at yeah. black players and so on. And so legislation helps. And yeah. maybe that's what's needed in the United States.
But there's no First Amendment here. And so you can, you know, so the laws... Speech that is protected speech in the United States is not protected here. So, I mean, people have gotten arrested for things they say on Twitter here if it includes racist language. And I don't, obviously, that wouldn't fly in the United States unless you do some rewriting of the Constitution, which is...
Well, we're getting on. I mean, this was just meant to be a short last talk. I mean, a woman was just convicted for laughing at Jeff Sessions.
To be sure.
I find it hard to believe that it's not a breach of the peace to use... racist language in public at somebody trying to do their job.
Oh, to be sure. All right.
But anyway,
we have...
done our drawing.
Yes, we have. For those long-time listeners know, we've been having this contest for people to try to encourage people to leave reviews of the show on iTunes. And we have some winners. And so, Frank, we had a drawing for your book. And who won for yours?
Debilitator.
Yes, all.
I don't think that's his actual name or her actual name. Debilitator has won a copy of my book.
And so for me, I have M. Garvey 81. So whoever Debilitator are at M. Garvey 81, could you please get in contact with us? Hopefully, you're still listening to the show with your at least your address. You don't actually. You need to give us your real name if you don't want to, and we will inscribe the books and send them off to you.
Yeah, direct message us on Twitter.
Twitter or email us. Our email addresses are open to the world. So do that. For all the rest of you, we'd still appreciate reviews on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod. We're also on Facebook. Until next time, Frank.
Cheers, David.